Welcome to episode 232 of Board Game Blitz, a podcast about all things board games that you can listen to in less time than it takes to convince your pets that their dinner time has changed post-daylight savings time. Board Game Blitz is sponsored by Gray Fox Games. This week, we're talking about what board gamers expect out of games. First, we discuss a couple games we've played recently, Holiday Hijinks Easter Escapade, The Case of the Curiously Correct Blueprints, and Cafe. Then, we talk about whether board gamers' expectations about the games they buy and play are reasonable, and how those expectations have changed over the years. And now, here are your hosts,
Ambi
and Crystal.
Recently, I got to play a review copy of Holiday Hijinks number 8, The Easter Escapade, which is one of the Holiday Hijinks escape room games. These are games that come 18 cards and it's an escape room designed by Jonathan Schaffer, published by Grand Gamers Guild. I've talked about the other ones before.
And we've interviewed Jonathan here on the podcast.
Yeah, so you can go check out that podcast for more details on Holiday Hijinks in general. But the Easter Escapade one, it's themed around Easter. It was fun. I thought it was a cute theme. You're like hiding the Easter eggs and the cards are Easter eggs. Like the back of some of the cards have Easter eggs on them. And so there were split up into like 2 to 3 puzzles per time area. And so you can split up into like have multiple people solving multiple puzzles at the same time. And then you all come together and hide the eggs together. So I liked it. I liked the theme and it was cute. Also, the last puzzle was cool, I thought.
I love when you're just like, you can't really say why, but you're just like, it was cool.
Yeah. Like at first there something, it seemed like it was a bunch of random stuff, but then like it came together and made sense. And I thought that was neat. And I'm trying not to spoil it. I don't have the box with me because I gave it to my kid's school librarian. I had mentioned to her about board games and she said she was like looking for board games to play with her family. And then so I mentioned like the escape room games because she was looking for cooperative games. And so I gave her some of the Holiday Hijinks games that I've played so that she can try them out. And she's going to try them out during spring break. Also, like those might be good for kids too. So maybe she'll be able to try them.
I've not played this one yet, but look, ta-da! I have the box for this one.
Yeah, you should play it. You get to hide eggs.
Well, that sounds like uber fun. Yes, I have this one and have not played it yet, but that's what it looks like for those of you watching on YouTube.
Yeah, and I guess I'll see, or I don't know if the librarian will, I'll have to like ask her if she plays it or if she like gets to play it with any of the kids at school or anything. That would be neat. Another review copy that I got and played recently is The Case of the Curiously Correct Blueprints. This is published by Bluefish Games, designed by Ace and Anna Ellett, but here it says it's an Elle's and Ernie mystery. So this is themed around a book club. So like the packaging is all saying like the book club thing. Here on the back it says about the author. They say write about what you know. Bug T. Carroll is not a criminal mastermind. Definitely not. So it's like a book and it has like fake book review things on here. And so when you open it up, there's a letter. This is a escape room style puzzle game. Not escape room. There's no timer or anything, but it's more like an audio book club puzzle game. On BGG, this says it takes 180 to 300 minutes playing time. I actually played it in 2 separate sessions and took a total of about 2 hours and 40 minutes.
So pretty close.
Yeah. So the theme is like, you're supposed to be part of a book club. Someone reads the book and then sends it to you to read. And then like you talk about it at book club. But the person who read the book before you, Stephen P. Hinks, which that's the same person in some of their previous games. They did the Curious Elevator of Mr. Hinks, was an escape room game that we had reviewed from them a while ago.
Yeah, we've also done a couple of Mr. Hinks games.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like it's in the same universe. But anyways, so he read this book and then dropped it in a vat of toffee or something. So he can't send it to us. And so he records his own audiobook of the abridged version of the book, what he can remember, but like leaves off parts for you to fill in yourself because he doesn't want to spoil it for you. So that's the theme of the game, which is hilarious. It has 5 parts. So it has like this little envelope, a little packet that comes with a pen and a bookmark and stuff. And then it has 5 envelopes that have flyers and stuff and different things. These are the puzzle parts. So each part comes with the narration. There's a website. You're going to use the website, listen to the narration. There's also a transcript for you to read if you don't want to listen to it, or like you can read while listening to it. But the narration is just flavor. Like you don't need that for the puzzles. And then like after the narration, then you can do the puzzles and you enter the answer into the website and then continue. The website also has hints. The hint system is really nice. It has hints for each section. So there's like 4 or 5 items in here. And so there'll be a hint like for this item, hint 1, hint 2, hint 3 for each item. And the puzzles were fun. I enjoyed them. Each item, usually it would have a puzzle in each one, but sometimes they're interconnected and there was a variety of puzzles and I enjoy that.
They have a really nice variety of things in their games, yeah. Like little trinkets and different types of puzzles and mm-hmm. just like little fun tidbits and things that you don't always see in yeah. other companies' content. Not that others are bad, but this one just, there's always a little bit of surprise and delight there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like all the stuff in here is like paper-based stuff. It's not like anything fancy metal keys or anything. So it's all like papers and stuff for the puzzles. But there was a mixture of like word puzzles, math puzzles, logic puzzles. I thought it was cool how some of them interconnected and stuff. You can write on the materials and then you wouldn't be able to reuse it, but you can also not write on them. So I ended up writing on like separate notes and so I can pass this on to something else. There was one item where I had to fold it, but it says right on it, fold here. So like that's not really a spoiler. And I don't think it would ruin it passing it on to someone else because...
Yeah, no, that would yeah. be fine.
So I enjoyed the game. I used hints once and I liked how the hints were laid out. The hints also like with the interconnected items, like I think that's what I needed the hint for because I wasn't sure like what order to solve them in. And so I looked for the hint for something and it's like, you need this other part first. I'm like, oh, okay. So if I'm stuck on something, it lets you know like, oh, did you solve this other thing first? And like, oh, okay. That's why I didn't know what to do with that part. And then for the audiobook part, I enjoyed the story. I don't listen to audiobooks, so I don't have much to compare it to, but I thought the audio part was nice. It had like Stephen P. Hinks telling the story. So it's like an old man voice. And then it also has like background music and some sound effects and stuff. So I thought it was a nice recording. I also was reading the transcript along with it because sometimes it does go kind of slow and you can't like do 2x speed or anything. So I'm used to listening to things on 2x speed. Yeah, so sometimes I would like zone out and then read the transcript. But none of that is necessary for the puzzle. So you can just like skip that if you want it to only do the puzzles. But it's fun to just listen to the story for the flavor text. And like this stuff is thematic. It's for the theme. The stuff in here kind of matches what's going on in the story. It's supposed to be like references for the story. Yeah, so I enjoyed it. And also when I finished, you get to put in your name to go on like the leaderboard thing, the show when people played it. And I was right next to NPH, Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw that Eric Summerer actually commented yeah. on your Facebook today and he was like, wait a second, did you finish this like a little while before me?
Yeah,
and also, right, who's that right below you?
Yeah. Yeah, so Eric finished it after me and I finished it after NPH. Yay!
Yeah.
That's my brush with Neil Patrick Harris.
Is you're on a leaderboard right next to him.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the case of the Curiously Correct Blueprints.
Well, I wanted to talk about a game that I actually got to play at Dice Tower West. Speaking of Eric Summerer, he was actually the one who taught it to me. So that's a nice little segue there. The game is called Cafe. It was published in 2020 by Pythagoras. It also lists 16 other publishers on Board Game Geeks because it's a Portuguese game, so I'm guessing that it's being distributed to different countries via different publishers, but Pythagoras is the main one listed on BGG. Designed by Costa Rola, probably mispronouncing that name and I apologize for that. So Cafe is a card placement action selection pick up and deliver style-esque game where you are producing, processing, and shipping coffee either to different little cafes or to your warehouse. The way the game works is players in turn order will draft new cards to add to their tableau. All of the cards are the same size. They're not standard playing cards. They are large. I would say even larger than tarot cards. It's kind of hard to describe the size, but they all contain a grid, a 2x3 grid. So they have 6 squares worth of content on them. Then when you draw a new card and add it to your tableau, you are required to cover up at least 2 squares worth of squares from other cards that are already on your tableau. You can cover 3 or 4, but you have to cover at least 2. There are some squares that are blank, but most of them have things in them. So inevitably, when you're adding new things to your tableau, you're often having to cover up things that you already have in your tableau. And those squares show the different actions that you can take, as well as different places that you can put your coffee beans to do things with them. So there's four different colors of coffee beans that you can produce, and those are all represented by cubes. And there are squares that will let you produce certain types of cubes. Then you can take those cubes and move them to other squares to dry the beans. Then you can move cubes to other squares to roast the beans. And then once the beans are roasted, you can ship them using particular squares, and they can go either to your warehouse or to different cafes, which are also located on the cards in your tableau. And certain cafes will want certain colors of coffee beans. Your warehouse can hold any colors of coffee beans, but at the end of the game, you'll score points based on the two colors of coffee beans that you have the least of. So you want to try and kind of keep things somewhat equitable in your warehouse. You also have to spend cubes from your warehouse to acquire new cards sometimes, because the cards will also have coffee cups on them. And what's neat about the coffee cups is they will give you additional actions on your turn. So a single action is like, okay, I produce red coffee beans. But you can get more coffee cups into your tableau by paying for cards that have coffee cups when you draft them. And now you can do more actions on your turn, up to a total of, I want to say it was like 8 total actions that you can take on your turn if you get all enough coffee cups. So toward the end of the game, you're doing a lot of different actions, and optimizing those actions throughout the course of the game is definitely kind of where the strategy comes in, because you can do different things on different cards, and it doesn't always have to be a single square that you're activating. Like if you group different beans all together in a single area, you can produce on all of them at the same time. So placement of the cards and action optimization all have to kind of synergize to get you to do things well. The game can be played anywhere from 1 to 4 players, and it plays very similarly solo that it does with multiple players. It's a nice little satisfying action selection game. I really liked it. The artwork is somewhat minimalistic, but nice, and it was really fun. I also found out that it is in alpha on Board Game Arena, so I will be able to play it digitally, which is very exciting. But I think I'm probably going to pick up a copy of this one for my collection as well, because I think it's relatively easy to teach. The theme is nice and cozy, because who doesn't love a good cup of coffee? And yeah, I just really enjoyed this one quite a bit. Oh, Ambie's raising her hand. She does not enjoy a good cup of coffee. You well, enjoy a cup of maybe tea, but there's no tea in this game.
Maybe I haven't had a good cup of coffee. I don't know.
Some people don't like coffee, but do you like the smell of coffee? Most people, even if they don't like the taste, like the smell. So
yeah, I like the smell. I like then coffee ice cream.
You can just think
cream.
Of the smell. Ooh, coffee ice cream is very good. So basically, if you like coffee ice cream, then you just need a coffee with lots of milk and sugar in it. And anyone that tells you that that's not real coffee is no, like don't let the haters win. If that's the way you like your coffee,
I don't think it's the coffee I like.
Well, I mean, do you drink cups of just milk and sugar with no coffee in them? I guess that's kind of like
a milkshake.
No, but
I've eaten sugar, just sugar. Like, I like just sugar.
Plain sugar.
Yeah.
A spoonful of sugar does make the medicine go down. Fortunately, I do not need any sugar for this game, because it goes down smooth regardless. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. Even though it came out in 2020, I had not heard about it. So I don't know when it got published here in the States, or if it just slipped my radar because of the pandemic. But yeah, I'm glad it's getting added to Board Game Arena, and I am looking forward to playing it a bunch more in the future. So that's cool. Cafe. All right, Ambie, for our thematic segment today, we are talking about expectations. So I wanted to start this off. It's one of those things that I think we as board gamers don't consciously think about a lot. But if you were to buy a new board game and open it up, there are certain things that you expect to be present in that box, both physically and kind of ethereally, I guess, not necessarily just in their physical components, but there are certain expectations that we have for what should be present when we open a board game box. What would some of those things be?
Rule book.
A rule book is definitely a good one. And what's interesting is there are some games that don't include rule books, I think. Like, or they, you know, sometimes it's like on the box lid.
Yeah.
Like, especially for older games. What else do you expect to see when you open a game box?
Well, like components. I guess it really depends on the game for me, because it's very different depending on the type of game.
It goes back to the whole we've discussed in the past, you know, what is a board game? And the term board game has obviously evolved used to mean a lot of different things. During our Blitzies episode, you were referencing the 21 different games that you can play with just your hands. And
oh yeah, that was just a book.
Right, that it was a book, and the games referenced in that book are not board games, but nitpicking over certain definitions is obviously less productive. But we as gamers do have come to expect certain things out of the games that we play, and those expectations, I believe, have changed over the years, especially as hobby gaming has become more prevalent. And I wonder for publishers how they approach the creation of their games, knowing that we are expecting certain things out of them.
I think with a lot of Kickstarter and deluxe editions now too, like, people expect better components and like better inserts and stuff. So you're expecting to have shaped meeples or custom minis and stuff and colorful things and then high quality cards and everything fitting in the insert and the little cover things on the inserts. Oh, and like, I think we mentioned a while ago, like, plastic baggies now are like standard coming in game boxes.
Yeah.
Whereas before it was like, oh, this game came with the baggies. Like, that never happened before. Yeah, now it's just
And now
like,
it's sometimes
oh, gosh,
too much.
More
sometimes
baggies.
It's like so many baggies.
Yeah.
Which publishers don't stop that. I prefer plastic waste aside, which that's a whole other issue, and obviously sustainability is very important, and plastic waste is an issue in general in the world, but I prefer to be able to organize my games, because otherwise when you just end up with a mess of components that you have to kind of just toss back in the box. And especially for those of us who like to store our games sideways, even if you have little like wells in the tray that you could theoretically put the components into, if you're storing the game sideways, yeah, that can get messy real fast.
And if the cover just like comes out a little bit, it'll fall. Oh,
it's so frustrating, because then you'll pick it up and try and close it and it doesn't close because all the components are like shifted down, and then you have to reopen the box and take everything out. And it's just, it's one of those things that in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't really matter, but it kind of does, right?
Board gamer problems.
It is. First world board gamer problems, 100%. But that's the thing. Board gaming, for many of us, it is not just the act of playing board games. It is also the collection aspect. We are investing not just time, but money into these physical items, and then we are displaying them on a shelf, obviously, you know, to be looked at to some degree by us or potentially other people who come into our homes. So there is, I think, some expectation there that not only should the box be functional, but it also maybe needs to look good too. And so I think art expectations have definitely increased over the years as well. If you look at games from the 60s or the 70s or even the 80s, you will see a lot of stock photography style art on the backs of the boxes, where it's just a photo of like a cookie cutter white family playing the game, like on the back of the box, which is really not helpful at all. Like, it doesn't provide anything meaningful to see people on the box playing the game that's in the box.
Well, at least it has like a picture of the game, right? So
that's true. Like,
that's
for
helpful.
Something like Mousetrap, maybe that's neat, right? To see the whole little Rube Goldberg machine set up. But in most, like, I don't need to see you playing Monopoly. You know?
But if there's like no picture of the game on the back of the box at all, then it's like, what is this game?
That's
so
true.
I do like having that.
Having an idea of what it will look like when it's set up on the table.
Like, yeah, the game set up or something.
I guess back then the rules were also probably a little less detailed, maybe. And so having that picture could have been beneficial for that reason as well.
Speaking of like boxes back then, like, boxes back then too weren't really made to last.
No.
Like, for example, Hungry Hungry Hippos does not even fit back in the box after you assemble it for the old one, because like, you snap in the hippos and then they're bigger than the box and you can't really take it apart anymore. But now, like, the new one, they have it like fold in and it actually fits back in the box, which is nice. But like, now, like, hobby board games, those boxes are a lot sturdier, and people expect the boxes to not have any like dings in them at all.
That's a whole I could rant on that for like a while. I understand if you're board game gets shipped to you and it ends up like demolished by the time it gets to you, that's one thing. But the number of people I see online complaining about like a like mushed corner of a box, like it only affected like the top, right, of the box, and it's like just mushed a little bit. I get that you want things to look pretty, but if it's not affecting the functionality of the box at all, that to me, especially when they like reach out to the publisher and they're like, you need to replace this box, like no, they don't.
That's
like
expensive.
Physical items are going to get damaged in transit, and the publishers who do ship out replacements for those types of things, good on them, honestly. Like that is above and beyond as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, I think there are some gamers who nitpick the little bits of damage a little bit more than they probably should. But we do expect the boxes to function over time. Mm-hmm. That is important, right? You should be able to open and close the box a lot and have it still function as a box.
Yeah.
I still have, we've talked, you know, about the games that I've carried over from my childhood, and those boxes are not in good condition. Like my Omega Virus and Mall Madness boxes, they are in rough shape. And I honestly, at some point, should probably like do some reinforcing with tape or something like that. But yeah, they don't hold up the same way that modern boxes do.
Yeah. I remember like having to tape a bunch of our boxes when we were kids. Also, like kids are a bit more rough with their boxes. So even the modern boxes for some of our kids' games, those I've had to tape up. But yeah, like the older games, they don't last as long.
So aside from the stuff that's on the outside, once you get into the box, we said we expect to see a rule book or a rule set, I would say, of some kind, whether that's printed in the box or printed into a booklet, components of some kind. If you're sending us a box, it's got to have something in it. And then I would say that in general, there needs to be an experience of some kind contained within that box. Obviously, that's a very broad and vague term, but the other parts combined need to create something unique. And that is what the game itself should be.
Yeah, I guess that's what we're expecting when we're playing the board game. We're expecting to have an enjoyable time.
I think that, as you mentioned earlier, kind of the past, I would say, decade or so of Kickstarter games has probably led to some really good changes in board game production, because it has allowed smaller publishers to do bigger things, because when they're getting the money up front, it makes it a little bit easier for them to, I would imagine, like for cost purposes and figuring out what they can afford and all of that, like to put in some fancier stuff. But I think it also potentially sets expectations higher for the future. As you mentioned, people are used to seeing like fancy inserts and deluxe components, maybe metal coins or miniatures instead of standees. And if you get a box nowadays and all of the components are kind of more akin to what you would have seen 30 or 40 years ago, like paper standees, for instance, or the little tiddlywink style plastic tokens. I think if I opened a modern game and saw a lot of those types of things, I want to say that I would be disappointed. And I don't quite know why that is, because assuming that the game is functional and those components lend themselves to whatever the experience is, I don't think they should necessarily be disappointing right off the bat. But we have kind of been built up to get these really crafted, curated components throughout the past, yeah, you know.
And it's fun when you open a box and you see these cool components, like opening a present.
It is. It really is.
Also, the expectations change based on the price of the game. So like, if it's a super cheap game, then I'm fine with like being paper stuff. Like usually like a party game is going to have like a pad of paper or something and it's going to cost less. But if it's a more expensive game, then I'm expecting higher quality, more expensive components and like it to look a lot nicer. But when I have like a relatively cheap game and then I open it up and it's like higher than average quality components, then I'm like, oh, whoa, that was better than expected. So
yeah,
it can go the other way too.
That's absolutely true. And I think that that tends to happen more often than the opposite. I think I've been more impressed with the production quality of a lot of games over the years.
Maybe because like we're used to older games, and so yeah. Now like manufacturing has allowed people to make better quality games, and we're still thinking about 10 years ago.
Well, and the growth of hobby gaming just in general has also led to publishers being able to take larger risks and do larger print runs of games, which when you produce things at scale, obviously the costs go down. So, you know, you can get better components for theoretically the same or similar costs to the cheaper ones if you're producing them in a smaller scale. But I do think that that has been an issue for smaller publishers that they've had to kind of figure out how to deal with. And Kickstarter has helped with that a lot. But then there are still small publishers who don't want to go the crowdfunding route and who have to end up charging more for their games if they do, in fact, want to include fancier components. But it seems like for those types of publishers, they usually have kind of already found their audience, and their audience wants what they're making generally. And so, you know, it's always kind of determinative based on who's buying your games, what types of games you're making.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different factors at play there. So would you say that most board gamers have reasonable expectations when they open a board game box?
Probably. I don't actually know most board gamers.
What? You don't know all the board gamers?
Yeah, but I think most board gamers are reasonable. There's just like a few, you know, loud ones online where it seems like they're all being unreasonable. But I think for the most part, people are reasonable.
I would say that that is mostly the case as well. And I do think that with any niche hobby product that people can learn to temper their expectations as well. And I think the longer you're in the hobby, the more you kind of get a better grasp of what exactly to expect from not just a game, but like a game from a specific publisher or a specific type of game.
Yeah.
And I think that can be helpful. But I also, I try not to have too many expectations about games. I've discussed in the past how I tend to sometimes judge games based on like the look of the box. And there have been games that I specifically didn't play because the name in the box just didn't appeal. And I don't know how to stop myself from doing that. Like if something doesn't appeal to me, it's hard to just say, Crystal, that should appeal to you, because why? Like it doesn't. One example is a push your luck dice game that I somewhat recently learned, and it's called Gang of Dice. And I hate the box cover. I hate it so much. My brain does not like it. And there's nothing wrong with it per se. My brain just doesn't like it. I don't like the name of the game either. And yet the game is super fun. It's a light push your luck dice rolling game, which is a genre I really enjoy. And I do like this game. But the box and the title, I do not like. I don't like them. I just don't.
I'm actually looking at the box cover now, and I think it looks cute. So
it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, why is the box a person with a mustache and sunglasses and a suit, and it's a pusher luck dice rolling game? It's weird. But the game is really quite fun, so I actually do recommend the game. But yeah, it's one of those things where I don't know how to subvert my own expectations in some of those instances.
But you don't always have to, because there's just so many games that come out. So part of that is just you need to
at a certain point, you just have
filter.
To throw some stuff to the wayside. Yeah. I guess you can't play everything. So if your brain decides you don't like that one, then I guess you don't like that one.
Yeah. And that's it for this week's Board Game Blitz. Visit our website boardgameblitz.com for more content and links. This episode was sponsored by Gray Fox Games. If you missed the Champions of Midgard 10th Anniversary Collector's Edition on Kickstarter, don't worry. Late pledges are available, so you can still grab a copy. And don't forget that whenever you shop at grayfoxgames.com, you'll get 10% off your entire cart, including exclusives, by using the code BLITZ10 at checkout. Join the Blitzketeer community on Discord for game nights, discussions, and more by following the link in the show notes. Support the show by leaving us a rating and review on your podcast provider. And if you like us a lot and want to support us monetarily and get some cool perks, check out our Ko-fi at ko-fi.com/boardgameblitz today. Our theme song was composed by Andrew Morrow. Until next time, I'm the one who wants to game with you. Deep inside, I hope you love games too.